Accession number 27229, Reel 1.
Bob Jones, Reel 1. Can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
I was born in Birmingham, 1920.
What was the date?
24th of October.
And what did your father do for a living?
He was an insurance agent.
Who did he work for?
The Liverpool Victoria, and on the side with the Commercial Union.
How did that work on the side? What
was that? I think he was allowed to work on a different basis. The Liverpool Victoria, he was not an employee. He owned his own book in those days. It's a mutual thing. But he was allowed to do business for Commercial Union, which handled things that Liverpool Victoria didn't do. So my memories of him coming in soaked on his bike after a day's rounds, and undoing his gaiters for him, and then sitting up at night writing his books up.
And your mother, what did she do?
Well, she just looked after us, yeah.
Did you have any brothers and sisters?
I have a younger brother, yes.
Mm. And what was the family home like?
Family home, well, before I was aware of things, I think about three, my mother decided she wanted to run a shop. So my father acquired a shop, sweets and tobacconist shop, with, of course, a house involved. And I think they bought the business but rented the premises. And they were there for 10 years until my grandparents died. And for family reasons, we decided that we should move in with my father's sister, unmarried sister, who also ran a shop. So I lived behind a shop until I left home. Sweets and tobacco and grocery.
What about your early education?
My education?
Early education.
There were all age schools in those days, 5 to 14. So I went to what my primary education and then passed the grammar school exam and got a place at Tansworth Grammar School in Birmingham, where I went at the age of 10. We had an express stream, which I got into, and therefore I took my matriculation at 14. I took my higher school certificate at 16, which would be A-levels now, and I started at the university at 16 and sat my degree at 19.
With your education, was there any particular subjects that you took great interest in?
Oh, yes. I just wanted to be a chemist. From before I went to the grammar school, I had a little chemistry set with one test tube and four chemicals and a book about a famous chemist. And I just decided that was what I wanted to do. And so I just lapped up chemistry as I went through the school.
And did you have any kind of hobbies or recreations aside from chemistry?
Oh, well, I was a tremendous Meccano enthusiast. I suppose that was my main hobby. But from the age of about 12 plus, I used to do a lot of chemistry at home, plugging a Bunsen burner into the gas stove and shutting the family out of the kitchen while I would do what I now, looking back, would regard as some fairly hazardous things. I was careful and I didn't do any daft things. I didn't make explosions or anything like that. But I handled some pretty dangerous chemicals, but I prided myself that I knew what I was doing and nothing went wrong.
Did the family encourage you in your hobby?
Oh yes, well, they were happy about it and they didn't try to put me off, but they had no background themselves for where they could positively encourage me, but they were quite happy about what I did. I think they were, anyway.
Did you play any sport at all at the grammar school?
No. I'm not a sporty type. And I where they, all my grammar school time, the sports afternoon was optional, and I never took it. The only sport I actually took a bit of an interest in was cricket, but I didn't play very much. But towards the end of the school, we had a master who started a tennis club, and I took up that tennis. I think I'm probably not a team sports type myself. I get on well with people, but it didn't really appeal to me. And I suppose I was happier on with a more individual sport. And I was also a very, very keen, from the age of about 14, a very keen cyclist. And I would go out cycling. I would go out for an evening, do 30 miles or something like that. And I had an ambition to do 10,000 miles in a year. But I think the last year at school, I managed 9,000. And then decided it. I was being a bit of a fool because I was keeping all these mileage records all the time, and I realised it had become a drug. So I took my cyclometer off and gave it to a girlfriend to keep, in order to stop the habit. But I loved touring and scenery, and I did a lot of that, youth hosteling and so on. It was my main physical activity. I must confess, this was just before I bought a car in my early 30s, I actually managed 200 miles in a day on a pushbike, because it was one of the things I'd always wanted to do. So I got a day off from the family and I did my 200. After that, we bought a car and I went downhill.
In 1930s, was it a common pursuit, or cycling? Would lots of people be doing it?
Oh, yes. It was very, very, very popular. There were lots of cycling clubs. And again, I didn't join a cycling club. I think I'm a bit of a loner, really. But I had a bunch of chums at school, and we used to go off on our own. We called ourselves a club, but I always decided where we went. I think there's one of those things about lone people tend to want to be leaders so that they can have their own way. Whether that's a characteristic, I don't know. I've heard of it before, anyway.
And where would you go on these expeditions? How far would you range?
On a Sunday, we'd go out perhaps about 20 miles and some sandwiches and come back again. We didn't do many big rides. Every now and then we do a big one, perhaps do 100. But, of course, Birmingham is the centre of England, and the Midlands is a very attractive country all around. And I have my favourite spots, which I make sure we got to quite frequently. And so I still have. Yes.
Where were they?
Mostly between Birmingham and the, unless you're going a long way, between Birmingham and the River Severn, the West Midlands side. It's beautiful country. The east is less interesting. It's more hilly and interesting on the west side. Whenever I can, now I managed to maneuver to go for a short break in that part of the world and stay at a hotel and then drive around some of the old spots that I used to cycle around.
Would you cycle to a specific place, or would you just tour around a little bit in an area?
We had a few sort of friendly tea places, that we used to call them, where there'd be some dame who would cater for cyclists on a Sunday lunchtime, bring in their sandwiches and make great pots of tea, and we would go for one or some of these tea places. But I would embroider a different route every time. In fact, I used to keep a set of maps, which you could buy at Woolworths. It's sixpence a sheet, covering the whole country. And they were basically uncoloured maps, except for the red main roads. And I used to ink in every road I cycled along, and I've still got them. And pretty well within about 20 miles of my home, I would say that I'd ridden along every road, almost. And I would sometimes go out on my own just to ride along a piece of road that I hadn't been long before, so I could ink it in. And I've still got the, map, so I'm very sentimental about things like that. And I mean, it's a a psychological word for it. It's a kind of fixation, really. But there are worse things to do, I suppose.
And tell me about university. What happened when you went there? Where did you go?
Well, I arrived at the university at the age of 16, which is, frankly, if I had my life over again, I would think that was a bad thing, and I would have been better at school a bit longer. But I got a fast stream, and that's how it happened, worked out. In fact, I got my high school certificate at 16, and intended to stay a third year. As the headmaster said, I would go to Cambridge and get a state scholarship if I stayed a third year, as some people did. And in fact, I started back in the September at school into my third year, and I'd been back about a fortnight, and I got a letter to say I'd been awarded an entrance scholarship to Birmingham University, with which meant free place, no fees or everything. And I went to my headmaster with this letter, and he said, well, of course you won't take it. And I said, well, and he was a very strong character, and I had to psych myself up, actually. And I had remembered one or two boys who'd stayed a third year and done no better the second time round than the first time. And I said, well, this is a bird in the hand. He said, well, no, you know, you stay another year, you'll go to Cambridge. And I said, well, I think I want to accept it. So I accepted it and I went. Well, I survived, you know. But certainly, I was probably 2 years younger than nearly all the others. And I found it a bit difficult, adjustment. But they say they all find it a difficult adjustment to go to university now anyway, I don't know. But it's very young, isn't it?
Were you still living at home at that point?
Oh, yes, yes. I lived at home, and I went on my bike every day to... It was just 5 miles instead of two to school. And in a way, it's a bit more like going to a sort of bigger school. And but it was a very, very good chemistry department. The professor was world famous, and in fact he was awarded the Nobel Prize while I was an undergraduate. Not because I was an undergraduate, of course, but he was a very eminent man. It was a famous school of chemistry, and it had a very good morale. Everybody was very proud to be there. And it was also a very sociable one. And once I'd got my sort of, I'd say sea legs in this context of this thing, but two things got me, not to grow up exactly, but I got interested in ballroom dancing, and I was made secretary of the university ballroom dancing club. And I acquired a reputation for being quite a good dancer, and I think I was, actually. I won a waltz competition once. And that was a big boost to your personal standing. And the other thing was that there was a long tradition at the university, in the chemistry department, of having two socials each year, and each one, in addition to a dance, there was a stage show put together, sketches and various things. And I gradually gravitated into the people, mostly older than me, more senior, who were doing this. And after a couple of minor bits, I actually produced the ideas for the next show, which was a chemical version of 1066 and all that, for the history of chemistry as it was really actually happened. And then I wrote two full-length pantomime shows after that. One based on the University Home Guard, called Yeomen of the Home Guard, actually. They were quite big shows, just ran over an hour with scene changing and all the rest of it. And that's how I met my wife, actually, because we knew, we need to recruit another pretty girl for the one show, and we talent spotted her, you see. And that's how we got together. But those sort of things brought me into the stream, and I felt more confident as a result of that. Well, it's a big confidence booster, really, which was more confidence boosting than my chemistry, where I was never really as confident as I thought I would be when I was younger. I found that a lot of laboratory work was very, very difficult, actually, manipulative way. And I don't think I had a real talent for it. I was interested in it, but there's a sort of talent for laboratory bench work, which some people have more of than others, and I don't think I've really quite got that.
Was that, do you think, partly as well because you'd enjoyed it so much as a hobby almost, that it was a bit more difficult when you were actually having to work in that kind of environment?
I can't quite decide, really. I know there were things I couldn't do at home because I couldn't afford to. I couldn't have a balance. I couldn't do anything with weighing anything. So when I got onto the more fine manipulative side of it, I found that much more difficult. And I think I'm probably more a bookish sort of type, really. I'm not a bench man. I think partly is that considering I think I was a bit of a loner, I really rather prefer company. And as a bench chemist, you're on your own. It's with stuff, not with people. And I remember I used to spend a certain amount of time at my bench showing some of the others how to do ballroom dancing steps, you know, making grooves in the floor, which is very bad, but that's how it happened, because I found some of the things I did quite difficult and not satisfying, I suppose, as a result.
Is there a type of person who makes a good benchman in chemistry? Is there a type of person?
Oh, yes, yes. There were several people there who were. I mean, the sort of thing I would say is that if I'm given a bit of instructions, I mean, my wife would say now if I go and get a recipe and think very rarely cook something, if it says 100 grams, I'll weigh 100 grams, not 101. And I would try and get everything exactly right, which would take ages. Another chap who became was a brilliant practical chemist, he would come along and he'd put four stuff in like that. He would weigh something and he'd take it off the balance before the balance would stop swinging. And all his stuff worked. And there's a kind of, it's a confidence factor to some extent, which I hadn't, I somehow didn't manage to develop. But I got a good degree. By the time I got my degree, the war had started. I took my degree in 1940. And most of my year, there were only eight of us at the end because a lot of people were weeded out when the war started. There were only eight of us, and only three of us stayed on. The others, the professor, sort of marched off into ICI and various other jobs like that. We were all reserved for military service, but I was given a research scholarship for a year, and it so happened that I was quite interested in the main famous field of Birmingham chemistry at the time, which was carbohydrates, and I'd rather imagined I would be doing that, but instead, virtually the week I finished my degree course, the professor decided that he was going to get into uranium chemistry, because they had just he had just heard that that a bomb was a scientific possibility from the man who did the crucial calculations in Birmingham, Professor Rudolf Piles, who was Professor of Applied Physics, who'd done this crucial calculation which showed that if you could separate the isotopes of uranium The calculated minimum size for the bomb was only a few pounds, whereas the previous calculation had shown it to be about 80 tons, which, of course, no one could have carried anywhere. And so it therefore it became a possibility if you could do this. And I've actually got the recorded words, not sound recorded, but written recorded words of one of the lecturers at the time, the senior lecturers at the time, who was with the professor, who came away from a conversation with the physicists, and he came away and said, "That settles it. This is going to be our war work. We're going to do uranium chemistry." And so he immediately got some money, got some uranium compounds, and switched half the department onto uranium chemistry, and that's where I came in, just like that. And so I spent my year making various uranium compounds, uranium metal, most of the work was not really research. It was just churning out more stuff for the more senior people to work. It was kind of a pair of hands, and I didn't enjoy it. And quite a lot of things I did were either completely routine, or the two things that I did was asked to try out didn't work. And so I got very, I wasn't at all happy with it. And the prof was a bit of a hair professor type, decided that I wasn't going to be helping get another Nobel Prize. And the way he worked was like this sort of thing. He sends his secretary in to say, "There is a job here which I think you might like to apply for." So you know you've got the thumbs down. And so this was as a technical assistant at an industrial gas works in the Midlands. An assistant of the technical manager, who was about 60. And I was told that if I was trained up, I possibly take over from him as technical manager. And I went off to this place. Well, I wasn't there more than about 6 months, and I thought, I don't know how I could live this life. It was god awful. And that's how I came to join the Navy.
Can I take you back a little bit, to the late 1930s, prior to the start of the Second World War?
Yes.
Had you been kind of following the situation in Europe?
Yes. I think I'd become old enough to be concerned about it. Probably got a bit of reflected anxiety from my parents, I expect, who had got two boys who were obviously going to be military age. But I don't suppose I got really interested until about, I would say, about 1937. By the time we got to Munich, it was 1938. I was very worked up about it, and I suppose I, for various reasons, I was very, very relieved when Chamberlain came back with his bit of paper, and I thought, there won't be a war after all. And it's very vivid in my mind, because the next spring, when he marched into Czechoslovakia, your whole feeling changed completely. And I suspect the whole feeling of the country changed from being petrified with fear in 38, the Munich time, of the idea of a war, to when Hitler goes into, takes over the whole of Czechoslovakia, you then know you're going to have one, and you've got to have one, and there's no excuse. I think there was a huge flip of attitude, and certainly I had it, but I think one was very conscious of this. I suppose the paper I read was my dad's Daily Mail, which was, of course, patriotic sort of thing, always was. But obviously one was very concerned then about, what was going to happen.
Did you think you'd have to take some part in it?
I don't know, because I wasn't sure. But what happened was the day the war started, well, it was a Sunday, and but it was going to be within about 3 weeks of the start of would have been my final university year, and so obviously I got on my bike and went straight up to the university to see if it was going to be open. And most of my chums turned up as well, saying, "What's going to happen?" So they said, "Well, you're all going to be interviewed by some sort of recruitment board set up in the university, at which we were all interviewed and told that we were reserved at least until we got our degrees, because they'd taken an early decision. They weren't going to let senior scientific people go wandering off into the forces." And so we knew that was how it was. In fact, I was still under call-up age, actually. And then they said, "Go around to the Barber Institute, because they're setting up a decontamination squad for gas raids." So the chemists were roped into the gas unit. And we had a few nights on duty in case there was a gas raid. It's all petered out in the end, of course.
How was that organised, the decontamination unit?
Well, I'm not quite sure how it was organised, but I know we all turned up and they said, "You've all got to wear, you know, learn to work with these suits on," which meant a pair of long johns and a long sleeve vest, then very heavy, I don't know what it would be now, sort of oiled, overalls. Bloody great gloves, Wellington boots, full gas mask, helmet, and you name it. And I remember that the very first night, they said, "Now we're all going to have a practice patrol." And about four of us went marching up. You couldn't walk properly in these things, going up the university road alongside the campus, where the courting couples used to go and sort of have a snog. And of course, we scared the pants off quite a few of them as we went by. Those are the ones that had got their pants on, I suppose, to start with. But that was quite memorable. We never, ever were called into action. And after a few months, it all seemed to die down. And they decided then that that job would be taken over by the University Fire Brigade. Who were sort of tough blokes. So it was a great relief, because I don't think we could have physically stood up to what we might have had to do with all this gear on. I mean, you had to lie on the floor to be undressed, with other people taking all your things off like this, and we were just soaked in perspiration with no real effort at all. And thank God it never happened.
Do you have any memories of that radio broadcast at all?
Of the radio? Not specifically. I don't. But as the war went on, I think we all used to sort of home in on the 9 o'clock news. But not at the very beginning, I don't remember much. But certainly family-wise, we used to sort of gradually, gather around the set, as they say, for the 9 o'clock news at night. See what was happening.
Well, slightly later in the war, people talk about how Winston Churchill's speeches were inspiring. Was that, would you have said that was the case?
I would certainly say so, yes. I don't think one can exaggerate the effect that his speeches had. Maybe we haven't got much to go on underneath it, but you don't know at the time. And I think it must have had a tremendous effect on the morale of the country, because when you look back on it and realise how we were placed, we were in a bloody hopeless position almost. What I don't know is, of course, how we would have got on if there'd been an invasion, because a year after the beginning of the war, of course, was my final exam as well. My final exams turned out to be while Dunkirk was in progress, and of course the country was absolutely like this at the time, and parachutists might descend at any time. And what do you do if you're spotting for your final exams? Well, we did, and we took them, but it was a very unreal sort of time. And then when I stayed on for the year, the university formed its own home guard section, home guard company, and I joined that. And that was... Well, it wasn't... Every time I see Dad's army, I think of the university home guard.